morning, friends. It's great to see you, and it's great to be here. Really, it is. We drove up yesterday, gorgeous, gorgeous drive, and got here, and the clouds started parting, and it looks like today's going to be a beautiful, beautiful day. And we got up here, and the classic cars are everywhere. What's the car show called again? Right, the Beach Cruise. Okay, I just make sure I get that right. And then there's the Elvis thing going on. So I was hoping that we'd sing, you know, Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog this morning, but that didn't come up at all. But just maybe for next year. It's just a thought. Just dig it up at the end, maybe at the end there. Anyway, it's really good to be here. It's good to see you. My name is Luke, as Dave said, and I pastor in a church in Fort Langley called Living Waters Church. I've been there for about 9 years now, and so I bring greetings and much love from Fort Langley. We have an awesome river, but it is nothing like your lake, so I'm envious and hoping to spend some time at the lake today as well. So I am, as Dave said, jumping into the series that you're in, which is the book, and I was able to chat with Dave about it and also listen to his teaching last week. And it was great. And I want you to know, Dave is a friend of mine, absolutely. But in terms of our area and our district, you are really blessed to have a ministry team and a pastor in Dave with a heart for the gospel, a heart for Jesus, and a real gift of communication. And I don't like blowing smoke or anything like that. But Dave really is one of the best communicators of the gospel that I know in our region. So you're blessed to have a great pastoral team, and I've been able to spend some time with them this weekend. So we've been jumping into this series called The Book, and just want to review a couple things off the bat that Dave shared last week so that hopefully we can be as much on the same page as possible as we move into this week's teaching. Dave said last week that the Bible is the most important and influential story, or book rather, in all of human history. And he also said that the Bible is a treasure map that leads us to a treasure, and that treasure is Jesus. And so Dave looked at three sort of foundational questions. The first was, what is the Bible? And the answer to that question is God's words about himself. Second was, what is the Bible about? Ultimately, the Bible is all about Jesus. Third, why should we read it? And Dave shared that it's because it equips, it connects, it shapes us, and we read the Bible, from what I can gather on your sign outside, not just for information, but for formation. It shapes us, because the Bible is actually filled with God's Spirit. And so when we interact with God's words, we're interacting with Him, and His Spirit speaks to us. So we not only actually get to hear God through His Word, but we get to listen to Him intently when we pick it up, when we open it, when we read it. That's a beautiful and a powerful, powerful thing. So what we're going to do today is we're going to continue on and ask some even more interesting questions about what the Bible is and who wrote the Bible. So we're going to consider the inspiration behind the Bible today and its relevancy. Essentially, why does it matter? We're going to ask the question, who really wrote the Bible? And that's going to lead us to an even better question, as I said, which is why does it matter? So last week, Dave already covered, you know, how the Bible was written. Really, you know, how was the Bible inspired? And did that in a broad sense, which is really that the Bible is written by God for our benefit because it directs us to Jesus. But what do we mean when we say it was written by God? Because clearly, it was written by humans in history. So what do we mean when we say that? I want to answer that question. I'm going to show you a photo up here. On your left is a picture of a rover on Mars right now. And the name of that rover is Curiosity. It's been up there for a while, and it's still going to be up there for a few more months. And it's kind of rolling around in a particular area of Mars, just surveying it, considering what Mars is all about, and if it's actually possible for maybe one day for us to colonize Mars. You know, maybe one day Bethel Church will have another campus planted on Mars. Who knows? It's possible. Your great-great-great-great-grandchildren could be going to church on Mars. Possibility. Just saying. Pretty cool. So this is curiosity. And what curiosity is doing here is it's taking a picture of itself. So it's taking a selfie. A robot is taking a selfie, effectively. I'm not sure who's taking the picture of the robot taking the selfie. So we're not sure about that. But that's what it's doing. On the other picture there, you see me, and that's my friend Chris. He's a missionary in Malawi. And the other week, we were getting together for a barbecue, and we had the same glasses on virtually. And I just thought, this is a moment that's important, and I want to document it. In both of these pictures, they essentially tell the same story. And that is that humans document history. Humans document history. Now, some history is more important than other history, but we document history. When something happens, we actually record it. And so throughout the Bible, what we see is God's action, the Creator's action on earth, and human witness, and then record of it. So just like we take pictures today, the biblical witness is a writing down of what God has been up to in human history. And we see that in two obvious parts as we first pick up our Bibles. We see this in the Old Testament, and we see it in the New Testament as well. The Old Testament is this very old story, but it's also a very new story at the same time. It's the historical narrative of the ancient Near East from a very particular perspective from a certain people group, and it includes an explanation of our origins. Most of the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, is set within this cultural and religious tradition of the Israelite people. So it shares, as Dave mentioned last week, their history, their politics, their religious activity, their law, their art. And the written tradition surrounds the Israelite interactions with their God, with their God. What is recorded about their God and their interactions with their God is that this becomes clear when you compare Israelite tradition and writings to other ancient Near Eastern writings, that this God is very different from other gods that were worshipped in the ancient Near East. Very, very different indeed. And that's one of the factors that has made the Bible and the Old Testament in both Judaic and Christian tradition so incredibly popular and has made it stick around for as long as it has. It's not like other ancient stories. Sometimes people say that, well, the Bible is just an old fairy tale. It's an old story that people tell. There's a whole bunch of those from the ancient world. It kind of goes into that category. The Bible is a very, very different ancient story, which is one reason why it's prevailed. Not a lot of people read about Marduk today, who is an ancient Mesopotamian god. Not a lot of people get up first thing in the morning and before they go to work as an insurance broker, need to be inspired and filled with the presence of Zeus, and so pick up ancient Greek mythology. They don't. People study in antiquity in universities, but it hasn't connected deeply to the human spirit, to what it means to be a human being. The Bible continues to do that. And so the Israelite story about their God is this radically different story that is surprising. It's shocking in the ancient world. And the New Testament follows on the heels of that. And Jesus points to this shocking kind of God. Most of the ancient gods that were surrounding the Israelite people were very predictable. They had to be appeased, and it was all about what you could offer the god, so the god, usually a male, wouldn't be angry. Or we've got the Greek gods, for example, who are obsessed with sex and power and control and entertainment. And that sounds a lot like you and I sometimes, doesn't it? I have a friend who's a scholar, and he says the Greeks are just us on steroids, effectively. They're a reflection of the Greeks at the time. So the Greeks, what they did was they projected themselves into the heavens, and that's what we see in Greek mythology. So they are predictable and disappointing. They are false because humans at the time made gods in their image. But the Israelite story is opposite to that. Totally opposite. They told a different story. They believed in one God who created everything, and this being was radically different. Not what they expected. This God made them in his image, And his image and character was absolutely distinct. And we read passages like Isaiah 55, where God speaks specifically to this in this interaction with the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah says this, "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake their ways and the unrighteous their thoughts. Let them turn to the Lord and he will have mercy on them." Mercy is not a particular ancient Near Eastern motif. It's not celebrated, really, in any other tradition except for the Israelite tradition. And then God speaks to this, and to our God he will freely pardon. And then God's voice pipes up, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." So Israel's God is, in antiquity, really an ancient anomaly in many respects. He's not selfish, he's not petulant, and he's not overly destructive compared to the rest of the gods that we see in the ancient world. He's actually bent and interested in the flourishing of the Israelite people, and through them, the rest of the world. So this is not a God who demands something from you. This is not a God who takes. As we read the ancient stories that we find in the Old Testament, this is about a God who actually gives. And that's the whole point of the story behind Abraham and Isaac. Abraham takes Isaac up to the mountain in the belief that God wants him to sacrifice his son, because that would have been what was understood in the ancient world. If you want to appease a God, you must give your very best and what's better than the firstborn son. Abraham, about to kill his son, God speaks and says, "No, don't do that." God's making a point and provides the ram in the thicket. This is not a God that we have to provide for. This is a God who provides for us. And so the place became known as God Provides. A very, very different story. And so the unique nature of this story is why it was recorded. These people memorized the actions of this God and their interactions with this God, and that's why the story penned and was preserved. Its distinctiveness is why we, I think, in many regards, still have it with us today. So the Jewish stories, which is what us, most of us Gentiles have grafted into, begs a very big human question that we've been asking since the beginning of time. That question is there really a God? And the question that follows hot on the heels of that is, what is that God really like? And throughout the Jewish story, we hear time and time again, this God is different. Different than you might expect a God to be. The next part of the story in our Bibles makes that absolutely crystal clear when we consider the New Testament. Something remarkable happens in the first century. More accurately, as Dave said last week, someone happened. Dave was right to say that the Bible is all about Jesus, and this is clear as we consider the Old Testament and then Jesus' impact in ancient history. Jesus is an absolute historical juggernaut. Nobody can touch him in antiquity. His life and teachings were so influential that his thoughts, his perspectives, his teachings have become the absolute foundation of Western thought. Historian Jaroslav Pelikan, who wrote a book called Jesus Through the Centuries, which effectively, he goes through century over century for 2,000 years, trying to show the massive impact that Jesus has had in our culture, says this at the opening address of his book. "Regardless of what anyone may particularly believe about him, Jesus of Nazareth has been the dominant figure in the history of Western culture for almost 20 centuries. If it were possible, with some sort of super magnet, to pull up out of history every scrap of metal bearing at least a trace of his name, how much would actually be left? It is from his birth that most of the human race dates its calendars. It is by his name that millions curse, and by his name that millions also pray." And so Pelikan calls Jesus the turning point in history. He's actually one of the people that coined that phrase. There's another philosopher named Charles Taylor. He wrote a book called A Secular Age. Basically, it's a very difficult philosophical book to read, but all he's trying to say is we have arrived here in secularism for a reason, and he points back to Jesus as that direction. He argues that we only arrived in individual secularism because of the foundation that Christianity set. What is individual secularism? Really, it's what most of your friends and neighbors would believe about themselves. They would essentially hold to these values that we would probably mark under secularism, but they wouldn't necessarily call themselves that. Most of these values are held to, values like generosity, values like equality. These things, people in our culture today who aren't Christians assume that these values have been here forever. They're just what it means to be human. But actually, they weren't present in Western thought until Jesus. Jesus is the one who has established these values that we hold to, so much so, and many of us don't even have the historical scope to necessarily know it. We just assume it's always been that way. So what this means is that the Jesus story, which is embedded in the Jewish story, is not a fairy tale. He's more than just a nice guy or a smart guy. He's historically foundation. Once again, his was a very different story, and it lasted and it shaped. And so the people who write about Jesus were deeply transformed by him, and transformed in a very short period of time, which is unprecedented in antiquity. The world looked different after Jesus. The surprising story embedded in the first century in the Greco-Roman culture that emerges from the Jewish story is simply this, that God is not distant, but near. That he's not far away, but he's interested and he's involved. And he actually gets his hands dirty. And this is the story that Israel's telling all along. And Jesus fulfills it. So many secular historians don't really know what to do with Jesus because we have this incredible volume of writing with which any historian worth their salt would say that this stuff is absolutely true. And next week, David's going to be talking about how can we trust the Bible. We'll go into some of those things. He's certainly an important figure in human history, but they don't really know what to do with him because he's had such an incredible impact. New Testament narrative, we have the Gospels, four Gospels. We have a whole bunch of letters, and they're all written within about 30 years based on the events of the interactions with one man over 1 to 3 years. That kind of impact in history is unprecedented in antiquity, and it turned up the world upside down. It's why we're sitting here today, all the way extremely far from Palestine, in the interior of British Columbia, and we're still talking about Jesus 2,000 years later. We're still singing songs about Jesus 2,000 years later. So yes, humans wrote the Bible, but it was because of the impact that God made in the world, because he got involved, he got invested in life. Because of the witness of God's proximity to us, we have this emerging belief that his direction is in all ways of our lives, and that would include the record of what he was up to, which is how we can say that, yes, humans wrote the Bible, but if God is actually so interested, near, and involved, then he must have been a part of the penning of these scriptures as well, which is why we can read from 1 Timothy 3:16. Dave mentioned it last week. All scripture is God-breathed. So I think that the Bible's nature actually seems to reflect much of God's nature. God is near, interested, and involved. And because of that, he didn't just take a bunch of notes from heaven and toss them down and say, this is how you live your life. He actually chose to come amongst us, live amongst us, tabernacle amongst us. That's what Christmas is all about. The Word became flesh and dwelt or tabernacled amongst us, embed himself in human history so that we can know what he's really like, and then allowed us to write about him, led us to write the story and reflect about who he really is, but directed us along the way. So to sum up, the Bible was inspired by God's action, but it was observed and recorded by humans under God's direction for our benefit. And next week, we're going to look at more of the trustworthiness of the Bible. So that's a little bit about the inspiration of the Bible. And I wanted to talk more on that side of the particulars that, you know, Paul wrote this, or Moses may have written this, because we could talk about those authors, but you can do that reading by yourself. What I want to highlight for you is the fact that God inspired the scriptures in an incredibly personal, near way. He didn't just toss us a book. He got involved and invited us to interact with him. Because a relationship with God is actually supposed to be that, an actual back and forth relationship. That's what he's inviting us to since the beginning of the story. So that's all well and good. The Bible may have been inspired by God in the middle of human history, and that's all very well and interesting, and philosophers and historians can talk about that till the cows come home. But does it really matter? Is the Bible relevant? Dave touched on some of this last week, but we're going to look more about it. Does it matter to the car enthusiasts? Does it matter to the Elvis impersonator out there on the street today? Does it connect with them where they live, where we live? I think the Bible actually is incredibly relevant because of how it was inspired. Because through the biblical story, we don't see that God is removed, we see that he is near. And if this God has taken 1,000 steps towards us before we ever take one towards him, then the story about him, the story we tell, will connect with who we are. It may be apparent to us that the Bible wasn't written in a vacuum, but a lot of people don't know where it came from. But John says this, who is one of Jesus' closest friends. In fact, some believe he was his best friend. John says this in 1 John, the very beginning of his letter. We have heard, we have seen with our eyes, we have touched with our hands, and so we share it. We have interacted with this God. We know him because he hugged us. We've heard him. We heard his teaching. We ate with him. We know this stuff to be real. So Israel's story helps us ask that question. Is there really a God? But the Jesus story asks that following question, which is equally important. What is God really like? And the answer to these questions have been found in the Bible, particularly in the New Testament, and encouraged people for centuries. This is a story about a God who gives life. Dave mentioned that as we were praying beforehand. This isn't a God who gives life by simply tossing it, again, blessing us from above and not getting involved, or saying, well, if you want to meet me, you have to climb up this holy mountain. No, this is a God who gives us life by coming and living amongst us, living our lives alongside us, who then makes his home in us by his Holy Spirit. The Word became flesh and dwelt amongst us. As God sent Jesus, Jesus sends the Spirit, and that's God's intent all the way along. And so what we find, I think, when it comes to the Bible and relevancy, is it relevant? First, I do think it's incredibly accessible. And second, I think it's satisfying existentially and emotionally. So let me talk about those two things. Some people think the Bible's inaccessible. They pick it up. They don't know where to go with it. But there's also a reason why there's a Bible in most hotel rooms around the world. That even though it's a few languages apart from us, it's been translated multiple times, it still connects. It is reachable and compelling. And I think it's that way because the Bible is understandable because God intends to be understood. That's the whole point. So even though the Bible was written when it was and by who it was in different languages over thousands of years, we are still moved, we are still encouraged, we are still challenged by it. And it's remarkable that we can be. Not many people have Plato's Republic just sort of sitting on their shelf and pick it up just to read for fun. You wouldn't want to read that for fun. It's not a fun thing to read. Most people have a Bible somewhere that they can get their hands on. Why? Because it's human, it's accessible, and it's ordered as such. And that's amazing considering the fact that it was written when it was by who it was. Think about this for a second. Just a little exercise I want us to do. Imagine that you were living 2,000 years later from here, okay? Let's reverse that. This will be even more fun. Okay, imagine that you wrote on a piece of paper, we are going to the moon, okay? And imagine then you put that piece of paper in a time capsule and you put it on a shelf and it sat there for, let's just say, even 1,000 years. And in 1,000 years, your great, however many greats there need to be, grandchild, picks that up. Perhaps a grandchild, who knows, picks that up and reads what you wrote on that note. We are going to the moon. They would probably read that phrase in a very different way than you intended to write it, right? So you may have intended to write it as in, like, we, the human race, are going to the moon at some point again in the near future, and that would be understandable, but it wouldn't necessarily be personal. But imagine them 1,000 years from now picking that up. What might that mean to them? We are going to the moon. Well, maybe it means that my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was going to go away for the weekend to the moon to his vacation home. Might consider it that way, right? You know, what moon is my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather talking about? Are you talking about our moon? We assume it's our moon, but perhaps this is a moon of a different planet. You can see very quickly that if you begin to scrutinize a piece of simple text like that, we are going to the moon, or we have gone to the moon, what we mean by it now could sound very, very different to someone 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, even 50 years if you were to tell someone, or 100 years that we're going to the moon. That would sound completely alien to them. The fact that we have the biblical text in our hands, in English, that we can read it and engage with it, and it still connects with us, that we still understand it, and it still touches us, is historically and emotionally absolutely incredible. And that's because it's alive. Dave said that last week. It's not just a dusty old book, but God's Spirit reveals his character through the book. So I do believe it's incredibly accessible, and there's great depth and beauty to that, because we have books like John, and one famous person wrote the Gospel of John, which we often tell people who have first become Christians to read as the first book in the Bible to read. You know, it's shallow enough for a child to wade in, but it's deep enough for an elephant to swim. Have you ever done a study of something like the Gospel of John? You're like, this is getting deep really, really fast. And yet you pick it up and you read something like, for God so loved the world that he sent his son, that no one should die but actually live. And it hits you in a very human sense. So I think the Bible actually is really, really accessible. And I think that the more we look and the more questions we ask, the more we'll be enthralled by it, the more we study it. Point two, I think that the Bible is also intellectually and existentially satisfying because it answers questions about who we are, where we've come from, and why we're here. And that's why books like The Purpose-Driven Life are so popular. Anybody read that book before by Rick Warren? Yeah, a lot of people. That's like a massively huge selling book every single year. And it's because it's based on the Bible and it asks questions like, why do I exist? What's the point of being me? And so unlike any other ancient writings, the Bible answers these questions and actually continues to stand up against his philosophical scrutiny. A lot of people have written stuff in antiquity that does not stand up to our philosophical scrutiny today, and the Bible continues to do in the world's best universities, many of which were actually founded on biblical principles and biblical thinking. It answers the question of life and death, God, mortality, meaning, purpose, the afterlife. And because of Jesus' influence, the biblical story is where we actually find our most treasured values. And so it's not only tells us why we exist, but it teaches us how to exist. It teaches us how to live, and not just live, but how to live well. I think the Bible, finally, is also emotionally satisfying because it's human. The Bible doesn't sugarcoat life like we often want to. Dave mentioned that last week. It's honest. It's raw. It has feeling. It speaks to our hearts. It's not just historically reliable and philosophically deep and theologically glorious, but it speaks to our hearts. It's usually more honest than we are. And it brings comfort to all kinds of people. This past week, I had a couple of challenging days. There was a baby that was just 2 months old in our congregation that died. And her parents knew before she was born that she wasn't going to really live past a couple of years. And so yesterday morning, we held the memorial for little Charlotte. And her middle name was actually Hope, which really speaks to the fact that her parents knew the scriptures, knew Jesus, and even before she was born, chose a name for her, which pointed to the reality that the scriptures directs us in, that there is more hope. So on one hand, I was working with this family and helping to plan this memorial for little Charlotte, and then on the other hand, I was helping to plan the memorial for my next-door neighbor who passed away just last month, and she died at 102. Two-month-old, 102-year-old. And as I worked with both of these families, both of them turned to the scriptures, turned to the person of Jesus, turned to God, and asked big, tough, life-altering questions. And the Bible has answers for them. The Bible doesn't have trite answers for them, but has deep, profound, healing answers for them. And it also has words like this: taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears them. He delivers them from all their troubles. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. The Bible is absolutely full of hope. And I think that's why it's relevant for everybody. I think that's why it's relevant for the people that put their trust in a classic car, or people that save up their money just so they can live in a town like this and hopefully die in peace. The Bible has more for them. The Bible has more for you and I. It has a hope of the life we can experience now and the life we can experience in the future. The Jewish tradition of which Jesus emerges from describes life as linear. And that was very different from the world that they were surrounded by. The rest of the world, the Greek-speaking world, the Greek-thinking world, described the world as cyclical. As that meant that because the sun, we seem to be going around the sun, and everything seems to be cyclical, and the seasons seem to be cyclical, human life must be cyclical as well. That means that I'm going to do the same thing again, again, and again. I'm going to be destined to make the same mistake over and over and over again. And that probably in the afterlife, I'm going to have the same kind of experience. I'm going to have the same kind of heartache, the same kind of struggle. And if I've been born in a lower class, or if I've been born with a diseased body, or if I've been born with a job that I don't necessarily want, that's too bad. That's my destiny. That's the cycle. And you're going to live in that cycle forever. A lot of people still believe that. A lot of people still live that there's no way of getting out of this depressing, sad death cycle, really. Greeks believe that. But that's not the Jewish story. The Jewish story is not that life goes round and round. The Jewish story is that there is a beginning and there actually is an end. And that God is moving us along that journey forward into hope. Which is why John can say, for God so loved the world, and the word that John uses there is actually cosmos. For God so loved the universe that he gave his only son. God has a plan for what he's created. And when we look at Jesus, we see what God is like. And the story of Jesus is that through Jesus, God ushers us into a new reality, into a new path, a new heavenly reality. We heard that very, very briefly, but we did hear it this morning from Reed. He said, God has a path for me. God doesn't have a gerbil wheel for Reed anymore. He has a new path out of brokenness, out of sin, out of death, and into life. That's what we read about in Exodus, isn't it? That God makes a way. That's what we see again in Jesus' life, in this new Exodus, where God makes a way. And with that in mind, we begin to understand why Jesus talks to his disciples about the future and not just saying, well, just live your life. It's never really going to change. No, Jesus says, and he says, this is how you want to pray when you talk to God. Your kingdom come, your will be done as heaven brings it to earth. Things are going to change. Things are going to look different, entirely different. There is hope for transformation and change. Life is not cyclical. It's not just the same old. It's not just old language. It's actually language of future and hope. And we read that throughout all of the Bible. So when we read the narrative of Joseph and Ruth and Jesus and Mary and Martha and Paul, we can be encouraged, I think, when we reflect on our own pain, on our own challenges, that actually life and hope is on the horizon. So why is the Bible relevant? Because it says that you and I are living in the continued story of God, that we aren't caught in a rat race, that we can live and actually move forward. And that narrative that we are in now is restorative and it's heaven-bent for all the momentum that God's heavenly creation is going to find itself in. It's not the same old stuff. It's something new. Not constant loss, but actually bright victory. Not reoccurring injury or death, but actually healing and resurrection. I want to just take us back to Genesis 1, maybe just for a moment. In Genesis 1, God makes everything, right? And at the end of making everything, what does he say? You've read Genesis 1, right? He says what? Give it a shout. Let's shout it out. It is good. He says, it is good. At the beginning of the story, we hear God say, it is good. And at the end of the story, when heaven and earth are united in a brand new reality, when there's no sickness, when there's no pain, we hear that same statement in the book of Revelation. We see a good universe restored by God. I think that we can sum up biblical relevancy and encouragement simply in this way. There was a good beginning, and there will be a good end. There's a good beginning, and there will be a good end. And there's probably some of us who are gathered here this morning who really do need to hear that. That you do feel that you're in the middle of the cycle. You do feel like things might never actually change. The biblical story, which you are now continuing, which you are living out of, says that there was a good beginning, that God saw you in your mother's womb, and he has a good end for you as well. As challenging and as hard as it is, there is a future, and there is a hope. And so the Bible has words for us, and we can cling to him in the midst of that. Words from Isaiah. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. Taste and see that the Lord is good, says David. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears them. He delivers them from all their troubles. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted, and he saves those who are crushed in spirit. If I can leave you with this thought, live out of the glorious hope that the biblical narrative gives us. You're not stuck. God has a way forward for you. And I encourage you this week to simply call out to him.